you for inviting me here. I am Fred Young. I am married to Helen Young, so if you went through RCIA in the last few years, you met the proof that I married up. I was born into an Episcopalian family. My father and his father were Episcopal ministers. And at some point, my father decided that he wanted to be a college professor. So he went back to school. And so I was born in Boston because that's where he was in school. And, there's a lot of different flavors of Episcopalianism, and one of them is something that's called Anglo-Catholicism. And this group of Episcopalians thinks that they found a way to be pretty much Catholic without having the Pope. And it turned out for me not to really work. And so in the mid-90s, I came to... We bought a house that's about two blocks away, and I don't think I was aware of Christ the King Cathedral when we bought the house. But in 94, 95, I said, Helen, I think we're supposed to be Catholic. And she said, well, okay. So I came down here, and I met the Helen, whose name was Red Seferman, and I sort of presented my Episcopal card and wanted to pick up a Catholic card, because of course I knew everything, because I was an Anglo-Catholic. And she said, that's not how we do things around here. You got to sit in the Highland Center for 9 months. It's kind of like having a baby. And then Easter Vigil, I came into the church. And then about 6 years ago, I applied to the formation program for the Diaconate. And that was all accepted. And then I was ordained to the Permanent Diaconate in February of this year. So I am a baby deacon. Ian, did you want to record this? Is this working?
Yeah.
Okay. Is that better?
I have such a good radio voice.
Okay. This is my phone. I don't share because this is the Android. I'm the affirmative action Android in an iPhone family, and my texts are the wrong color, and I'm not in the fam group, so I miss a lot of what's going on. So I've decided ignorance is bliss. Tell me all set? All right, there we go, look at that. I can kiss. Okay, so I didn't buy the book, and I don't think I watched all the videos, so I apologize if I wander away from what you guys did last week, but I think what we're doing is carrying on in this topic about moral relativism, using the materials from Dr. Edward Street, I think that's how you pronounce it, and the Augustine Institute, okay? And I think you guys are, this is fantastic that you're looking at this because, as you probably already know, according to the words of Pope Benedict XVI, we are underneath a dictatorship of relativism. What Father Mike, that was his name, said, you know, they play the offense card and that ends the conversation. So we're going to talk a little bit about those things. But first I thought I would go through and just make sure that you and I are at least close to each other on what we saw. Working. I have all this cool stuff and I forgot to turn it on. There we go. Okay. So this is kind of the recap about why it's hard to talk about human morality. And I put up some of the kind of things we sometimes hear, right? We hear when we want to bring up something about right and wrong, and that's what morality is about, correct? And you'll hear, well, who are you to talk to me about that? When you were younger, as a teenager, you might have said, you're not the boss of me. I heard that from my teenage sons relatively frequently. When you were even younger, you said, I do it myself. I think this is the new way we say that. Who are you to talk to me about that? You also hear people say, well, let's just live and let live. And then the real conversation ender when people say, well, that's your truth, and you can't tell me my truth. And then try to get along, but why can't we just all get along? If you guys are not old enough to know who about Rodney, I can't even think of his name, Rodney King, but that was what he claimed after he and some policemen got in a big fight back in the early 90s. And then I put two sentences down here, which I think kind of speak to the heart of the challenge. It is pretty much received truth today in the media that you have every right to choose your gender. If Bruce announces that he is now Caitlin, he's Caitlin, right? No matter what Caitlin looks like in the shower, what was Bruce is now Caitlin, and he has every right to choose his gender. But you have no right to be a racist. So it's kind of interesting that in a relativistic world, we still end up with absolutes, don't we? And I think Dr. Sri kind of made that point in one of his talks, that our conversations are not consistent in sort of the framework for how we have conversations. If there was such a thing as your truth and my truth, how could we have any semblance of community or societal order? And we can't, really, can we? And so what we as Christians, if you remember the stuff that Dr. Sri talked about, he kept talking about classical this and classical that. Okay, so what we're dealing with is the fact that around 1100 AD, okay, so that's the Middle Ages. People went around on horses and they didn't have cell phones. The king of England knew, and the peasant at the bottom of their social structure knew, that the king and the peasant both answer to the same God and the same rules apply. Now, the king got away with things that the peasant sometimes didn't get away with, okay? But they both knew where goodness and truth came from, and they looked to the church for being called to account. And I picked that date because if you guys are familiar with the story of Thomas Becket, he was an English priest who was getting in the way of King Henry II. And King Henry II, in a fit of rage, said, "Who will rid me of this meddlesome priest?" And four of his knights went off and killed the priest. Now, the king wasn't there. He didn't commit the murder, did he? But he knew that he was responsible for it, and everybody else knew that he was responsible for it. And so about a year after the murder, Henry II, who was the king of Aquitaine, of most of France and all of England, goes to England, which he didn't spend much time in England, goes to Canterbury Cathedral, puts on a hair shirt, and crawls on his hands and knees in an act of penance into the cathedral. That's about the last time that a king would do anything like that, right? I mean, if Donald Trump or Barack Obama or Bill Clinton got caught doing something, you're not going to see that, are you? I mean, we now have Harvey Weinstein in the news, and it's woman after woman explaining in pretty graphic detail how he took advantage of them, his power. And he says, "Yeah, I've got a problem. I need to go to a retreat on that." Okay. That's not the same thing, is it? But that's the world we live in, where Harvey, just to use him as an example, doesn't really think he operates under the same rules of behavior and conduct that those young actresses operate under, and which is why Harvey can do what he wants to do and they have to deal with it. Does that make sense to you? Okay, so here we are trying to be faithful Catholics in that world, and that's the challenge that I think Father was talking about. Dr. Sri talked about what he called tools for better relationships, and he was reminding us about the virtues. Is that a word that you guys are familiar with? Okay. So this is, again, looking back to the classical world, even before Christ. You can have ethics without God, right? That's what the Stoics were, and that's what the Epicureans were. That's what Socrates and Plato were, right? They're trying to figure out what is the good, and they don't know about the real good, the good news of Jesus Christ, so they're doing the best they can. And they came up with this idea of virtues, which have been described as excellences. That's a good way to think of it. But the root word of virtue is the same root word as the word of a man, vir. Okay? So what is it that makes you the man you're supposed to be? That's kind of their idea of what a virtue is. And they categorize them and kind of organize them. And we as Catholics and Christians think of them as two different types of virtues. There are the natural virtues, and these are virtues that without any reference point to God, you can kind of make sense and you can use them. All right? And there are four of them. One is justice, okay? And justice is frequently defined as giving to God and to man or another person his due. Okay, that's what justice is. Another way, and I think this is the way Edward Sree talked about it, is that when we're following justice, our body follows our soul, and our soul and our appetites, our passions, you know, our hungers and our lusts and our urges follow our will. That's our will is when we choose things, right? I choose to do good. I choose to do bad. It's the choosing that is what our will does. And our will follows reason. And I believe Dr. Sree said, now let's turn that around. I will pretty much describe today's, the world that you guys grew up in and are living in, right? My will dominates my reason. I may know it's bad, but I gotta be me, right? The purpose of my will is to satisfy my appetites. I wanted to get a little buzzed, and then I decided to start torping beers, and before you knew it, I was hammered and throwing up, and the cops had to come. I have no control over my appetite because I am nothing more than a collection of my body parts. I don't have an order to it. Okay? So that's kind of justice is saying, you take all of our animalistic urges, and we direct them and have them operate in accordance with reason and our eternal soul. Make sense? Okay, I see some nodding, so I'm going to go with that. All right. Another of the four natural virtues is temperance. Temperance is also called moderation. And let's take something like eating. Eating is good, right? But we need to moderate our desire for pleasure according to reason. So, in an immoderate attack on pizza, we ate seven pieces. Pizza's good, but maybe one or two pieces is what a moderate, what temperance would teach us. Fortitude, or courage, is that strength that helps us do something good and overcome the obstacles that get in our path of doing something good. Okay, so it is courage on the part of the fireman to go into the burning building to rescue the baby. Okay, he's doing a good thing and he's overcoming the obstacle to do it. It is courage, perhaps, that leads me to have the strength to take my cell phone and not look at pornography, okay? I needed courage, strength to do, overcome the obstacle to the good, okay? And then prudence or wisdom is the guy that helps me understand how to apply these. It's not courageous to run into a burning building for no purpose whatsoever, right? That's just being foolhardy. Okay, so it is prudence that tells me that's dangerous. And it might be courage that reminds me, well, actually, I'm doing that for a good reason. I'm going to go save that baby. So I'm going to overcome the danger and my fears to do the good. But it's also prudence that makes me look both ways before I step across Peachtree Road. Right? Does that make sense to you? In the ancient understanding, they frequently describe the passions and appetites as, you know, horses pulling a chariot. And prudence was the charioteer that kept the horses in order and had them productively move the chariot forward. So those are the natural virtues that even if you're not a Christian, they make sense to you, and you can organize your life around them. The theological virtues are virtues that we can only get because God gives them to us. And if you know your Pauline scriptures, you're going to know the other two after I give you the first one. First one is faith, okay? You can't reason to faith because faith sees higher and farther than reason or experience can go, okay? It is faith that we know that we are saved, okay? You look at Jesus on the cross on Good Friday, it's through faith that you could see to Easter morning, correct? Because if you just look at it on Good Friday, somebody got killed. That's the end of the story. But it isn't the end of the story. And it's by faith we know that that's not the end of the story. And the second of the three theological virtues is hope. Hope is directed to the future, and it is that confidence that my values are not just random, that they actually point to something that is real, okay? It's not a figment of my imagination. It is actually there. Heaven is a real place, and that is what gives me the strength to keep on keeping on, because I have the hope of heaven. And finally, love. I think Dr. Shree quoted C.S. Lewis. C.S. Lewis also has a very nice little talk about love, and he points out that in the Greek language, there are four different words that are translated into the English word love, and they mean different things. Very briefly, one is, when I say I love the Braves, you know, what I mean is, through the habit of being around the Braves, and being around people who say they like the Braves, I've come to have some affection for the Braves, okay? But it's not love in the same way as some other types of love are. When I say I love my brother or my friends, that's a filial type of a love. And like you know, the city of brotherly love is Philadelphia. Philos is this brotherly love where I love my friends from college, but it's not the same as loving the Braves, right? And it's not the same as eros, which is that desire to possess love that I have with my wife. And none of those are the same as the self-emptying love that in Greek is called agape, and in the Latin word that translated is caritas, charity, which is salvific, it's sacrificial, it's creative, and it's redemptive. It's so clearly modeled on the cross that Jesus gave himself for all of us. And we read our scripture and we go to Good Friday service and we listen to the seven last words. One of the words is there on the cross, Jesus is still offering salvation to the two thieves. One of them accepts the gift and one of them doesn't. But that's the love of the cross. That's the love that a husband is supposed to give to his wife and vice versa. If you haven't seen on YouTube the four-minute video called I Want a Crucifixion Type Love, you should go see it. It's a fantastic video. But it speaks to the fact that if I'm going to be a good husband, I want to love my wife the way Christ loved the church. That's what St. Paul tells Ephesians or Galatians. And that's going to be, I'm willing to kind of make a fool of myself for her. I'm going to say no to my friends because this love I have is higher order than that philos type of love. I'm certainly not going to a Braves game if what I need to do is love my wife in this charity way. So those are the virtues, what Dr. Shree called the tools for better relationships. And you can see how some of them come to us in the vertical dimension of the cross. God just gives them to us. And some of them are clearly going to be useful in getting along with each other and treating each other properly. Okay, so if we live this life of virtue, and I confess that I discovered how to animate things, so you get to watch this, okay? It just hit me one day. Obviously, I suffer from a lot of pride, okay? And pride is the deadliest of the seven deadly sins, and it occurred to me that the letter I is at the heart of both of those things, and that I must die to sin. St. Paul talks about that, and the capital sin is pride, which is deciding basically, I decide to take on things above my pay grade. Okay? Adam and Eve were told to live in the Garden of Eden and to not eat from the tree. And the serpent came up, and he didn't take the apple and sort of jam it in Eve's mouth, did he? He talked to her, and he said, "Now, come on. That looks good, doesn't it? You know, if you eat that apple, you're going to know what God knows." And Eve said, "It does look good. I want to know that." And so she arrogated to herself something that she was not called to do. And that's really at the heart of pride, is taking myself too seriously, not seeing my brothers and sisters because I'm so focused on me, which is why I is at the heart of pride and sin. And that's the opposite of love, which is willing the good of the other just because. Love is not a trade. This type of love is not a trade. If you're in business, you take somebody to lunch, there's some implied sense that he'll probably take you to lunch the next time, right? So that's not really a gift. It's just sequential trading. Human relationships that are beautiful shouldn't be based on trading. God doesn't trade with us. He just gives himself to us. We're not worthy of the gift, but he gives himself to us. And so we're supposed to try to live that way, which is kind of hard in this world because sometimes we feel like we're the only ones trying to do this. Okay, so what I'd like to do is I want you to basically shout out. When people say of freedom, and I'm kind of contrasting the world from the church, okay? So when the world's talking about freedom, what do they mean?
Do whatever you want.
Do whatever you want, okay?
Say what you want.
I didn't hear that. I'm going deaf. Wasn't worth repeating.
Okay.
Yeah. The word I picked, license, right? I get to do what I want to do. Okay. And there's a implied, I recognize there might be some collateral damage here as I get to do what I want to do. But I kind of hide in that thing about, you know, if you're going to make an omelet, you might crack a few eggs, right? I understand that it's a little bit of a bruising approach, but that's what freedom really means to the world, doesn't it? Harvey Weinstein was free to do what he wanted to do until eventually enough people said, you got to stop that. So what does the church mean by freedom? Any ideas? Yes.
Detachment from sin.
Detachment from sin? Love that.
The freedom to do what is right.
The freedom to do what's right? Yeah, that's great.
Salvation.
Yeah. God's will for your life? Yeah. So the word I picked was integrity. That I, Dr. Shree talked about being the telos, being the man as you were oriented to be, what you're supposed to be, that every person... that we as human beings have a purpose, and integrity is aligning ourselves with that. Submitting, putting ourselves under, that's what submit means. Submitting to the truth and love and authority of God, who loves us so much that he died on the cross for us. So, you know, it should be a joyful submission. But all of a sudden, if I put myself under the protection and guidance of God and his church, I am free from an awful lot of pain, am I not? Okay? The pain of going to some social setting to meet other people and be taken advantage of by those other people, to be manipulated by other people, to be treated as an object by other people, to be treated as a unit of work, an input to a process by my boss and my companies. There's lots of places where we are dehumanized because we have allowed ourselves to think that freedom is license, when freedom is really living an integrated life. You know, an integer is a whole number, right? So I need to be a whole man. I cannot compartmentalize myself. I need to be a whole man. Wherever I go, all of me should go. So I can't make bad choices on Saturday night and then be a good guy on Monday morning. I need to be making the same choices using the same mentality wherever I go, whether it's Saturday night or Monday morning. Okay, so to talk at your tables about how you felt inside, okay, and you know, maybe there's such a thing as oversharing, I get that, okay, but think about, I'm sure, now I'm a little bit older than you, I joke that you got to take 20s plus 30s to get to me, but even in your 20s, you probably can think in your life you've made some choices where they really were corresponding to godly freedom, and other choices when they were really corresponding to the worldly definition of freedom. So I'd like you guys to talk with each other at the tables about that and really concentrate on how you felt afterwards. I think that God is speaking to us through our hearts a lot, but are our hearts sensitive to what he's saying? Okay, so take some time to do that if you don't mind. That's awesome. Just so you know, real awesome is, you know, when you are in front of, well, that's if you're from Boston. But awe is actually, should involve a little bit of knee shaking, you know, so I gotta imagine if you walked up next to Shaquille O'Neal, and he's 7'2", 300 pounds, and a great athlete, you would be like, hi. There's going to be a little tinge of respect bordering almost on fear, reverent fear. That's really at awe, which is really what we should have when we are encountering God. So maybe we can come up with another word for, you know, that's great. But we use awesome, so let's continue to use awesome. So what kind of words came up? I'm going to guess maybe shame. Is that a feeling that you had after you'd chosen license? Any other words like that to describe feelings?
Despair.
Okay.
Pity.
Pity. Okay.
Guilt.
Right. Yeah. Right. So what's at work that makes us feel those things? Our conscience. Right. And just so you know, if you feel shame because you did something like, I don't know, at a one-night stand or something like that, that's a properly formed conscience. If you didn't have some shame or sense of guilt about these choices, you wouldn't have a well-formed conscience. So God uses these negative emotions to help us go where he wants us to go. How about the feelings that you had when you made good choices?
Peace.
Peace? Yeah. Anything else? Awesome. Exactly. Okay. The right kind of proud, right? So I heard the word confession a lot. There are some that go skipping into the confessional. That ain't me. Okay. But you feel good that you did your duty. Even if you didn't get spiritual consolations, some people come out of there and they are walking on cloud nine, right? But even if you just went in there and said, yeah, I did this, and I did this, and I did this, and I did this six times, and I did this seven times, and you don't get some kind of a bubbly feeling, at least you feel good about the fact that you did the right thing, right? That's not really pride. It's just kind of a satisfaction, I think. And God is using that also to kind of encourage us when we make good choices. When you're the one that didn't go out and, you know, eat vodka shots or something like that. Okay? You're trying not to feel smug or superior, but you feel good about your choice. And that's good. And that's your conscience saying, way to go. And it's hard, isn't it? It's hard to consistently choose the good. And that's why we try to develop a life of virtue. We get in habits, because everybody, you know, if you get in the habit of going to Mass, that day when you wake up a little bit hungover and you like to sit in bed, you kind of get up and go anyways, don't you? Because you've got the habit of going to Mass. And the same thing with, you know, bad habits. You're going to have habits, so you might as well try to have good habits. And the life of virtues are those good habits. All right. Any questions or other comments about that before we move forward? So now, why is there a moral law? We've talked about freedom, and we talked about how that puts us kind of in harmony with true freedom, puts us in harmony with God's will and God's law. So I thought I would remind you of scripture verses that you probably kind of know already. If you've done anything with theology of the body or anything like that, you know this verse. God made man in his image. Male and female, he created them. So we are wonderfully made. We are made for a reason, and we are the greatest thing God ever made. And we should never forget that. So part of why there's a moral law is to remind us of our inherent dignity as God's greatest creation. If anyone ever tells you that a dog or a tree is as important as you, love them, but know that they are not correct. You are infinitely more important than the greatest tree or even a Labradoodle. My son and his girlfriend have a Labradoodle. We are obsessed. Okay? But here's the other thing. The dirty, smelly grifter who's always waiting at the corner by the Starbucks where I go get my coffee, he has exactly the same dignity given to him by God as I do. And so what God is frequently challenging me to do with the moral law is don't get distracted by the Labradoodle. Look at your brother, the homeless guy, even though he stinks and he's probably going to take your money and make bad choices, but you've got to love him. And that's part of why I brought that verse up, is to remind us that we are all God's children, regardless of our earthly station. No other person is better than you, and no other person is worse than you. People make good choices, and they make bad choices, but their inherent worth, their inherent dignity is the same, because just like you, they got it from God. Jeremiah, this is another kind of speaking to the fact that God has a plan for us. This is the verse, if you've been in the pro-life stuff, you've probably seen this one before. I formed you in your mother's womb, I knew you. And for Jeremiah, I had a plan for you to be my prophet to my people. And God has a plan for each one of us. It's not the same plan. Each of us has our own plan. But we have to develop a life of virtues so that we can hear God telling us what our plan is. If we get out of the habit of listening to God, perhaps we missed the vocation he called us to. Perhaps, none of you are there yet, I find myself as a single person at age 45, not because I'm unmarriable, but because God has been calling me for some time to be a monk or a sister or a priest or a consecrated layperson, okay, which is really what a monk and a sister are. They're consecrated laypeople. And I just wasn't in the habit of listening to him, even though he sent messengers, but I had kind of dulled my tuning away from the voice of God and to lesser voices. So we have a purpose, and we should try to listen to hear what it is that God has for us to do. This is the kind of this is the answer to the first question in the Baltimore Catechism. If you have a copy of the Catechism of the Catholic Church, you might have the hardback version because eventually the soft pack breaks and then you have all these pages flying around. But it's 500-600 pages thick. The Baltimore Catechism was the catechism put together by the U.S. bishops in the last part of the 19th century And it was set up to help teach elementary school kids their faith. So it was set up in a simple kind of question and answer format, and the kids would memorize the answers. So every Catholic over the age of 70 knows, why were you made? To know, love, and serve God in this life so that I can be with him for eternity in the next. That is your purpose. That is every Christian's purpose. The details of how I'm going to serve him will change. But that is what we are all called to do. And that's why there's a moral law. Okay? The moral law, I like this picture because it reminds me, if I'm driving on this road and I pay no attention to the white line or to the wood fence, what's likely to happen? Yeah, that's right. I'm at least going to get hit the tree and I might end up having to fish the car out of the pond, right? So the rules are not there to punish me. They are there to protect me. That fence doesn't have any words on it. But every one of God's fences says, on the other side of me is a lot of bad stuff, and I don't want that to happen to you. So stay on this side of me. That's why we have the moral law. And sometimes we think it as a series of gates in front of us to block us. It's a wall, okay? And I guess we're going to make Mexico pay for it. But really, it's a guardrail to protect me from bad things. And if I start moving too fast, I may come up and bump against the wall. And that's why the walls are pretty, the guardrails are pretty strong, so that I can, it can withstand a certain amount of bumping. And we have here the healing from bumps, which is called the sacrament of reconciliation. And when I really bump against that guardrail, maybe I even crashed over it, the sacrament of reconciliation will help me get back on the right side of the moral law, back in alignment with God's plan for me, back in a warm relationship with God who loves me. I'm going to love him back. And I'm now going to be free, truly free, because I'm back living as a man of integrity. Okay. So, now I know what I'm supposed to do, and I know my tool set that I'm using, and now I'm out talking to regular folks. And they don't all wear a cross in the middle of their forehead like we do on Ash Wednesday, so I don't know who I'm talking to. So one of the things, if I'm going to have a dialogue about right and wrong, anything kind of deal with morality, is I kind of need to figure out who I'm talking to. So I've kind of... setting as in opposition, am I talking to a child of the church or am I talking to a child of the world? If I am talking to a child of the church, then when we talk about morality, it will become apparent that he shares with me the idea that morality comes from God. But if I get the sense in my discussion with him that morality comes from him, those, some of those quotes we had at the very beginning of this presentation, I'm beginning to able to discern who I'm talking to. Another one is a person who's trying to live his life in conformity with the ideals of the church knows that he has a purpose greater than his will, but we all know people who believe that their purpose is to satisfy their will. I picked on Harvey Weinstein as a good example of that. I get what I want when I want it. That's why I'm here. That's not the way Christians are supposed to think. And we've talked about freedom. Is freedom submitting to God's will, or is freedom is license to do what I want? And in our conversations with people, these are kind of what we're trying to listen for so we know who we're talking to. And finally, am I living for death to self, enforced by humility? Humility is not weakness, okay? Meekness, it's meekness. And humility is not thinking less of yourself, it's thinking less about yourself. pride is mostly thinking about myself. I don't really have any time or brain space left because I'm so busy thinking about myself. Humility is always putting myself in the right spot in the picture. Normally, when I paint a picture, I'm right in the middle, right? Well, that's not always where I really am, and that's what my pride tells me. And a child of the world lives according to... You guys know who Nietzsche was? He was a German philosopher at the end of the 19th century. And he was writing at the time of the end of the modern age. Remember I talked about that English king in 1100? Fairly soon after there, new modes of thinking came in. And we had a long stretch called modernism, where people tried to come up with a system of ethics that didn't make reference to God or the Catholic Church. And Nietzsche was writing at the end of this period, where he suggested that if God is dead, and he thought he was, then what we have left is will to power. Okay? And it's basically the guy who's willing to do what other guys are not willing to do is the guy who's going to win. And the life is about winning. And the best way to enforce your will is using wrath. If I can frighten people, they'll do what I want them to do. Intimidate people. So that's kind of the kind of a checklist to have in my mind as I am in dialogue with people. And I think I have an example of an online dialogue. So first let me check. If your Twitter handle is Bawana86B, please stand up. Okay. So this is some tweet conversation. The guy at the top whose face is chopped off is some Hollywood guy who is right of center and tries to be reasonable. And he's made some comment about if the Alinsky mob wins, America dies. And then in Joe Biden form, he said, this is not hyperbole. I love that. So, you know, Joe Biden always said literally when he clearly didn't know what literally meant. And then this other fellow named BSJY said, if we do not return to objective truth and objective morality, more than America dies. And he likes long hashtags. Hashtag resist the dictatorship of relativism. Whoever the first guy is got a lot of followers, so his replies pop out. And this guy, Bawana86, said, whose objective morality? Let me guess, yours? Now, is that not a classic tweet? Okay. It's like a drive-by smack, isn't it? Okay. Bawana86B doesn't understand the definition of the word objective. Okay. So BSJY has two choices. Find a meaner, snarkier, more vicious insult, or to walk away. Okay? So I have a choice of license or freedom. The loving thing is to let Bawana86B be where he is and not correct him with an extra bit of vinegar. But you can see the temptation, right? Because Bawana went to school on a short school bus. I don't know that he did, but you know, that's the kind of thing that might have got tweeted by BSJY if he wasn't careful. Okay, so what I'd like you guys to talk about, you've kind of seen the tool set and the framework I use to kind of figure out how to talk to people that I run into, because we don't all spend our life in Kenny Hall sitting with like-minded people who are trying to follow their Lord and Savior. So we're out there. Talk at your tables about ways that you can discern that a discussion is going to be fruitful or not, okay? And then, how are you going to end it in a godly way? Charlotte reported that the power has gone out in your main cathedral. So, so use candles, that'd be great. But let's go through, what did you come up with as a way to figure out that this is a fruitful discussion or it's not going, you know, a good place?
In the discussion, if that person rarely or never reflects back to me their conception of what I understand, trying to, like, represent it back to me, I probably know they're not understanding where I'm coming from.
Okay, that's a great idea. If you don't hear it coming back, at least the words. Okay. Yes.
Yeah, kind of going off of that, you're saying about just if the other person's listening to you in general, if you can already see them, like they're already working on their counter argument, they're not even listening on what you're saying in that moment, it's not going
to
go anywhere.
Yeah, that's a great point. Am I pausing for my chance to speak, or am I actually listening to you? That's a great point. Yes.
So if people are asking questions, it might be a science group, but if they're telling you stuff,
hey, that's a great one. Yes.
If they go to like extremist scenarios to try to find that gray area, I feel like that's another way that you could say that it's not a fruitful discussion because they're trying to find any possible way.
I see. So they're sort of, yeah. They
that,
just
like,
won't meet you?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a great one. That's a great one. Anything else? Yes.
Can you talk about relationships that you already have with them and just kind of know based off your relationship if they're interested in learning the answer or if there's no.
Right. The history you already have with them. I don't know of 186B, but now I kind of think I do, right? How about how to end it in a loving way?
Gotta go.
Gotta go.
BRB.
Gotta go. Okay. Anyone can anyone trump that?
Let's agree to disagree.
Let's agree to disagree. Is that successful?
That's cool.
Sometimes I feel like if I say that, the next thing out of their mouth is, well, you're a hater. You know, that it's back to Father Mike's thing that you're not allowed to be of goodwill and disagree. Am I the only one that, maybe I don't argue very well. I feel like, okay, but let's agree to disagree. Anything else? Yeah. We have wisdom, but no voice back there.
How you say it,
okay? How do you say, what was it, gotta go?
Yeah.
How do you say that in an unloving way, or a loving way?
Bathroom.
Yes. All right, yes.
Say
that one more time.
Building a relationship while you speak, and then almost just like,
excuse me bothering you, it is fixed.
Oh, good.
So if
praise
you
God.
Kindly text Monsignor.
I will certainly do that.
Thank you. And
I
thank
certainly
you,
do
everybody,
that.
For your patience and your prayers.
Thank you, Charlotte. So, Charlotte is the head of our Marian devotion group. They're doing a Cenacle of Prayer right now, I think. So, say that one more time.
Yeah,
me too. It's not the phone's fault that I have no attention span.
Thank you. So building a relationship while you speak to them, making them feel like you can relate with them, kind of like what we spoke about here, and then also the way you convey the message is never a message to them what they need to do better. It's if they ask you, you can tell them what you're doing, but the whole time you're doing it with kindness and not like, this is what you need to do better, because that makes
that's a great point. A lot of it is kind of the common sense stuff you probably learned in business communication seminars, right? About to, you know, validate their position without necessarily endorsing their position. Validate their right to have a viewpoint, and seeing if perhaps they'll hear your viewpoint, but sometimes they won't. Yes?
Oftentimes, it's very difficult to convince someone of the truth, and what you have to do is maybe just question assumption that they're making,
mm-hmm.
and allow them to reach the conclusion.
Yeah.
So like if they do say something and you don't agree with it, just be like, you know, is that true? And maybe leave it there, or because you're not really going to convince them, you're not going to convert them on that day, is what you were saying.
Great point. You know, it's a marathon, not a sprint, isn't it? Yes.
Well, nobody wants to be wrong either, so try it. It would just be either, you know, hurt your pride, it could be embarrassing if you were to be, oh, I'm wrong, I admit it. And so if you approach it in that way, you're not trying to prove them wrong, but just give them a little something to think about and something to question their assumptions.
Mm-hmm.
And so afterwards, that resonates in some way.
Mm-hmm. You know, it really helps to really know your that you're correct and that you have enough information that if it was a sort of a conversation of attrition, you could outlast them. Do you guys know who Father Robert Sirico is? He's the head of the Acton Institute, and it's kind of a Catholic free enterprise center of thinking. And I read his biography. He was a typical 70s Marxist-Leninist graduate student, he said. And he was living in some apartment building, and he kept coming and going with this fella. And somehow or other in their conversations, he would parrot the Marxist-Leninist slogans that he had memorized. And the fella would smile. And one day, the fella said, "Robert, you're delightfully ignorant." And then gave him some books. And so somehow or other, that fella, you know, "You're wrong." So, but he said it in such a way that Sirico was intrigued rather than felt offended. Jesus certainly shows us that in his encounters with the woman at the well. You know, she's got five men and none of them are her husband. And when he speaks that truth to her, she responds, "I think I've met the Messiah, come meet him," rather than slapping him, which is probably what would happen to me if I said that. So it's very difficult. But I do think that the more you actually know, the less nervous you'll be encountering somebody who either reeks of ignorance or knows enough stuff to fight. You know, most of the battles are between people who, you know a little bit. But the part they know a little bit, they know really, really well. So they just keep using that one at you. But they can't actually sustain an argument. And if you have learned enough so that you can say that's a great point and then offer something else that they don't, sometimes that helps them realize that perhaps they don't know everything and they might be open to the book that you're going to suggest. Yes, sir.
You mentioned one small piece of that, sustaining an argument, and that just really brought to my attention a recollection that Bishop Robert Barron just actually gave an interesting talk at Facebook a couple of weeks ago on how to make a religious argument, and I think he has that on his website or in his podcast, Word on Fire. So if anyone's kind of interested in getting like the bishop's take on like how to do that in like a secular society, which I think relates a lot to what we're discussing tonight, it's definitely a worthwhile talk.
Okay, great. Yes?
I also have a comment. I think it's also important when you're dealing with this to not treat it like an argument, to put yourself in the other person's perspective and understand where they're coming from. Like, look at that Twitter guy. I think he was doing exactly what other people have said. He was asking questions to prompt you to, or whoever that was, to question their assumptions. My objective truth is that
he might have been.
Yeah, there's a common perception that there is no objective law because who interprets what objective is? Like, you might say it's coming from God, but who are you to determine what God says? That kind of thing. So what I do, what I would do in a situation like that is ask more questions and build a relationship long term and wait until I know what to say. Like, even if it's weeks or years from then, because like I had to do that with a lot of my best friends.
Right.
We can talk about things now we couldn't in the beginning. Mm-hmm. But I would ask them, okay, well, tell me more about what you believe without coming up with a rejoinder, without even criticism, no comment, just listening to see where they're, who they are as a person.
Correct.
A lot of times, beliefs have more to do with, like, my atheist friends. I cannot talk to them about atheism without knowing who they are. We can't discuss who God is until I know who they are and where
that's
all that came from. There's always a history there.
That's a great point. And also, you know, to make sure we know the definition of words, okay? So the point about 186 was he doesn't know what the word objective means. Okay? Objective, what he's talking about is subjective, okay? Objective, it just is, okay? A triangle is a three-sided figure. And you can have feelings about triangles, you can like them or dislike them, but objectively, that's what a triangle is, okay? And he didn't quite know that's what the word meant. Another word that we've used it twice here tonight, is argument. And Robert Barron is not talking about a confrontational discussion, which is why we usually use the word argument, right? I said this, and she said that, and then I said this, and then she said that, and it was basically a verbal fight. He's talking about the philosophical term, argument, which is a reasoned discussion trying to arrive at the truth. Okay? So You can have a Robert Barron argument with a person as long as you don't turn it into a personal argument against another person where you're insulting the person. And it's just nothing but a back and forth of attacks on the person. Yes, sir.
I don't want to be off topic, but in that example, what would your response be? Because I feel like what he was saying is just because you say that's objective morality, I don't accept that what you're saying is objective morality is objective morality.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's subjective. How do you know that that's not subjective to you?
Correct.
So I feel like that's what, while maybe poorly articulated, that's what, you know, Wanda 86 was.
Don't you love that? Okay, I think that's entirely possible. It's also possible.
Because, I mean, how do you argue with that?
Exactly.
Right.
So my discernment there, assuming I was BSJY, is to say, I don't think this is going to be fruitful.
Right.
And so the best way for me to enter this Twitter thing was to not tweet back, correct?
Right.
Okay? There might be another setting where I actually could get to know Bawanda 86B better, and then maybe we could go out to dinner and I could find out that he really doesn't know what objective means, and he's open to finding out what the word really means. Okay?
Like there, even if you take out the personal element, like how would you personally approach this person for the good, reasonably, logically, you can't win that argument per se.
Right. In the deacon class, the first year, they make you take a logic class taught by Father Augustine Tran. Who is that? He always wears the cassock and the white cassock. He's the chaplain of BT, so he's out there doing karate kicks on the sideline of a BT football game. So he was trying to show examples of non-arguments because there are ways that a person's statement is not an argument, not a valid argument. And they were all political slogans because politicians realized, rather than have an argument, I'll just attack the person. That's what an ad hominem fallacy is. I'm not actually going to enter into a reasoned counterpoint to the point I hear you making. I'm just going to call you fat. Okay? And you can't argue with that because he's no longer participating in the argument. He's just distracting you from the argument in various ways. And it was really cool to listen to him because it helps you understand, I can't have a Robert Barron argument with this person because they won't argue. All they do is these other ways to distract and dominate and deflect. And so part of the discernment is realizing, that's why I kind of went through this, realizing, oh, I can love you, but I can't really have that kind of a dialogue with you. So I'm going to have to keep my dialogue and conversation with you at a certain level, like you're saying with your atheist friends. Maybe later we can go deeper, but right now it looks to me like the only way for it to be fruitful is for me to keep it here, okay, and always remaining open. Well, those are great comments and answers to these questions. I hope you enjoyed it. I am done. I understand, is there like a stump the deacon section now? Is that what the question stump is? My daughter is in BC Calculus, so I think I do know the answer to how many angels can dance on the head of a pin, but after that I'm kind of done.
What is that answer?
22.464. Questions about what we talked about. If you are trying to stump the deacon, I'll do my best to not be stumped. Yes?
If there's a book that you've read in your life, besides the one we're reading now, related to like this topic of making in arguments or relativism or whatever with respect to our faith, would you have any recommendations?
I do. I'm reading both of them. Bishop Chaput, Chaput. I think the one that's out now is called Render Unto render unto Caesar. And he wrote a one about 10 years ago that's on the same topic about how do I live out my faith in what I finally realized is a pagan world that doesn't operate under the same thought process as I do. And it's great. He is a happy, joyful warrior for Christ. And so, you know, I got the first one on ebook, and then the second one I decided I wanted to underline. But you start with that, it's a great one. Another great book, it's a little bit older. A little bit older is a book by Peter Kreft, though it's spelled Kreeft, K-R-E-E-F-T, called Back to Virtue. That's a great book. And one of the cool things about it is first he explains how the world went to pot. And then he says, let's use the seven deadly sins and have a reflection as contrasting one of the deadly sins with one of the Beatitudes. And so it's an excellent, I think if you have like a small group, it would be an excellent book to read because it's got a lot of heady stuff, so the that part would be satisfied. And then it also has a lot of kind of you know, heart, gut kind of stuff. So those are some books I think would be very much worth your time.
Thanks.
I have a lot of books. So if you want to borrow it, just come find me. Anything else?